Queering, escaping from the normal, a minor life out of joint, as deviance and delirium of dissemblages.
I'm glad to introduce Gerald Raunig, who works at the EPSP. He's one of the editors of the multilingual publishing platform Transversal Texts. Books are over there. Transversal Text is also running a multilingual web journal and a blog. Gerald also teaches at the Zürcher Hochschule der Künste, Zurich University of the Arts, as a professor of philosophy. I'll just mention of the many books that Gerald has written, two recent ones, which have also been published in English. I'll mention the English titles. One is Dividuum, Machine Capitalism and Molecular Revolution, Volume 1, published with Simeon Dexter in 2016. And the other one is titled Assemblage, Machine Capitalism and Molecular Revolution, Volume 2, published with Minor Compositions. And actually, there's a recent one that I, the most recent one, which I should also mention. It's titled Making Multiplicity. Came out this year with Polity Press. And I'm pretty sure that, without knowing in what way, that the molecular and multiplicity will play a certain role in Gerald's text.
Welcome, Gerald.
Queer is individual, never bound to an individual. There is no queer identity. The queer is anti-identitarian and becoming similar. It is not substance, always subsistential, always in something, under it and around it. In this respect, messy hair can be queer antennae, open arms, feelers, that are attracted and touched by other hair and arms and feelers. In March, we drove to the Portuguese border and bought a second-hand Rhodes E-Piano Mark II. It was manufactured in the 13th week of 1981. Around 1981, I already had a Fender Rhodes, a Mark I from 1974, which was already hard to play at the time. While the new old electric piano is being renovated over the summer, I'm exploring the small record collection for records from that time on which a Rhodes is used. Rhodes pianos with phaser, chorus, or tube overdrives, Rhodes pianos in the songs of Grover Washington Jr., Roberta Flack, Herbie Hancock, Stevie Wonder's songs in The Key of Life, Riders on the Storm, Billy Preston as the fifth Beatle on the LP Let It Be, and finally, the Traffic album from 1974, When the Eagle Flies. On this album, which Traffic recorded on an 8-track machine in their own studio between July 1973 and June 74, Stevie Winwood experiments with all kinds of keyboards, with Moog synthesizers and the Mellotron, and with the Rhodes piano. This album also contains the song Dream Sharar, which has always appealed to me. The combination of funky groove and psychedelic sounds, the title itself, the lyrics were completely lost on me, but at the time we were used to cryptic lyrics and nonsense, and besides, it wasn't so important to understand the English lyrics word for word. In any case, I obviously was not meant, but another Sharar with a double R. Winwood, who had started out as a 15-year-old boy wonder with the Spencer Davis Group in 1963, had risen to become part of the British rock establishment by the end of the 60s and then developed into a star and mainstream pop musician. While to many of his fans, the LP When the Eagle Flies seemed more like the decline and swan song of a supergroup, the late psychedelia of the album was always very close to me. Winwood's phrasing is influenced by his rhythm and blues experiences with the Spencer Davis Group, plus that funky rhythm and a dose of soul, but the lyrics are pretty arty. Even by the standards of the time, the vocal line interrupts units of meaning and even words and rearranges them, and you don't really know whether Winwood knows what he's singing when he sings Dream Sharar. He had co-written the song with someone else. In the Rees, through various obscure channels, I found out who Vivian Stanchel was. Perhaps the most peculiar representative of a whole generation of music-making art students in 1960s Britain. Vivian Stanchel didn't invest in the developments of psychedelic rock and progressive rock, but was always a little more innovative than his musical surround during his work with the Bonzo Dog Duda Band, between Commedia dell'arte, music hall, and anarchic performance. However, as an English Dadaist or a neo-Dadaist, he was also suspicious of innovation and originality. With the Bonzos, he didn't try to be original, but instead stretch fragments of existing musical forms with monstrous surreal poetry in a style quite volatile. Their props and puppet machines, grotesque costumes, and absurd theater influenced the Monty Pythons avant Monty Python, the late Beatles, and the early John Peel, but not simply as stage outfits and performances, but more and more often flowing directly into everyday life in order to denormalize it, to deterritorialize it, to bring it a little out of joint, out of the furrow. In the early 70s, it all somehow got stuck, peculiarly localized as English humor, which probably also subverted itself consciously in order to avoid too wide a dissemination and international marketing as far as possible. But the overlapping underground and bohemian lifestyles, the specific aesthetics of existence after London became swinging, led to ever new social machines and musical collaborations. What was peculiar about the British 60s and early 70s was that there were strange and persistent overlaps between socialities and milieus, such as that of the freaky camp and anarchic neo-dadas and dudas who had outgrown their art academies and a rock scene that was not yet quite so polished and still open in terms of style to which Steve Winwood belonged. In 1973, two biographies of Gérard de Nerval were published in English by Norma Rinsler and Ben Sowerby, and Vivian Stanchel read at least the second one, probably finding many parallels to his own restless and unruly life. The fragile relationship with a father returning from war, the existential unsteadiness, the experimental artistic forms, the craziness of everyday life, the mental breakdowns. All of these are overlaps between Vivian's and Gérard's lives across the centuries. Not least, the motto of Gérard de Nerval's last novel, Aurelia, from 1854, "Dream is a second life," had a strong impact on Vivian Stanchel. And ultimately, it also led to the central message in the refrain of "Dream, Gérard," which deplores the fact that the transitions between dream and life are suppressed in favor of a limited concept of reality. They won't let it be. They think it should be done with reality. From the concatenation of dream and life, as in the subtitle of Aurelia, to making impossible repressing, clashing this very threshold, this joint, the vagabondage between dream and life. In just a few lines, Stanchel's lyrics cast four spotlights on the life and writing of Gérard de Nerval, on the relation of life and dream, on the life forms of the bohème galant, on Nerval's writing style and aesthetic technique, and finally on his death. These are all points of reference from the Nerval biography The Disinherited by Ben Sowerby, which Stanchel could easily link to his social surround and the aesthetics of existence in the 60s and 70s. And it's a fact, you are cold, they react, dream Gérard. The introduction, like the refrain, focuses on Gérard de Nerval's central theme and technique, the play with all possible thresholds, all possible transitions from and into the dream, from daydreaming to hallucination, from delirium to machination. Dream Gérard is the dream that Vivian dreams together with Gérard in this song, but also Dream Gérard, the transversal intellect, the individual crowd of ghosts writing with the poet Nerval, his social surround of the bohème galant in the 1830s, those that he translated from Goethe to E.T.A. Hoffmann to Heinrich Heine, the formative female figures of his life and his texts from Pandora to Sylvie to Aurelia, and perhaps even us in a queer present who revisit the minor stories of long past aesthetic and political struggles 50 years after Traffic and Vivian Stanchel. Hippos don't wear hats, lobsters shriek if provoked on long blue ribbons, sums up the eccentric actions of the bohème galant in the 1830s in two short formulas, which are drawn from the wealth of anecdotes in Nerval's biography. Gérard is in his 20s, and he enjoys going to the Jardin des Plantes. There he stood for some time watching a hippopotamus in a pool. Finally, he threw his hat at it and went to visit the paleontological galleries. End of quote from the biography. Vivian Stanchel transforms these sentences from the biography into the short version, "Hippos Don't Wear Hats." In the song lyrics, the hatless hippos are supplemented by another animal species and an early form of flaneur. And the biography says, he had appeared in the Palais Royal arcades leading a lobster on a ribbon, and when questions had replied, "Why is it more ridiculous to have a lobster to follow one than to have a dog or a cat or a gazelle, a lion or any other beast? I like lobsters. They are quiet and serious. They know the secrets of the sea. They don't bark, and they don't devour one's substance like dogs," which Goethe found so antipathetic, and moreover, he was not mad. End of quote. Mad or not, for Vivian Stanchel, these references to the bohème galant and their weird performances in Paris in the 1830s were directly linked to the spontaneous appearances in the everyday life of London pubs and clubs in the early 1970s and to his own pranks, And one can imagine that Toscaeus would not have been entirely averse to such fun with his surrealist friends in the 1940s. That he may see while he sleeps. Monsieur Old Neddy wears spectacles in bed, that he may see dreams more clearly. Monsieur Old Neddy is Seurat's friend, the poet Théophile Dondet, who anagrammatically changed his name to Philotée Old Neddy and was so short-sighted that he always had to wear spectacles. The biography reads he would even wear them while he slept, for he said that without them he could not distinguish his dreams and lost all the enchantments of the night, end of quote. So it is not necessarily the idea of analysis or dream interpretation or X-raying the dreams, of constructing a normality of dream, that lies behind the desire for clarity to see dreams more clearly. What drives O'Neddy and Vivian Stanchel to wear glasses when sleeping is much more the fear of missing out on the magic of the night, on its enchantments of not seeing clearly enough if they don't wear glasses. The queer vision of dreams harbors the magic of the night. But the night not only has its enchantments, it will be black and white, sleepless. The night will be black and white, raven croaking, I am thirsty, die. The biography reads, on 24th of January 1855, he wrote to his aunt, "Do not expect me this evening, for the night will be black and white," end of quote. A white night, une nuit blanche, a sleepless night. And it is also a black night, at least this night, in which Gérard de Nerval puts an end to his life. And the croaking raven is reminiscent of the poor malade from Aurelia, whom the first-person narrator calls brother, and who, on the last page of the novel, awakens from his coma thanks to Gérard's attentions and says, "I am thirsty." For all the concrete experience of suffering in limbo, the queer magic of the night is an attack on normalizing discourses and an indication that the boundary between art and delirium remains threatening for all parts, inwardly towards its subjects, but also outwardly as a component of molecular revolutions. There is one more sentence between the refrains that cannot be unraveled directly and explicitly in the biography. "Fritz, bring your wigwam." I interpret it as a figure of vagabondage that traverses Nerval's life, desires, and works. Fritz is the Germanophile Gérard de Nerval, who at the end of his life always carries his belongings with him, his home, his subsistential territory, pitching his tent wherever he happens to be. The biography notes about the last year of his life. Since he had left Passy, he had no permanent residence. His vagrant nature had reasserted itself. As so often before, he spent whole nights wandering about Montmartre, the markets and the suburbs, sometimes mingling with sordid company in the cheapest all-night taverns frequented only by the poorest laborers, thieves, prostitutes, and vagabonds. He slept little and wherever occasion provided. During the day, too, he wandered about the city in search of inspiration or sat in a cafe with a blank paper before him, end of quote. And this is what Vivian Stanchel explains about the writing of Dream Gérard together with Steve Winwood and in a similarly volatile situation. He says, "I was suffering a severe bout of depression when I was staying at Steve's house. And he said, 'We're off to dinner. Are you coming?' I said, 'No, I'm reading about this French poet and I don't feel very well.' So he went off and I wrote not more than a quatrain about Gérard de Nerval. When he came back, he said, 'Right, that's a chorus. We need a verse for that.' And he went into the front room and started plonking away on the piano."
Delirium, delirium,
secondly, the queer deliriums of Gérard de Nerval. 100 years before surrealism and Art Brut, which would briefly intersect in Saint-Alban with the social machines of asylum and resistance. Gérard de Nerval invents a realism of dreams in manifold facets between delirium and poetry. Despite the softness of his minor masculinity, he does so with incredible sharpness of radical realistic observation and description. Thus, the dichotomies of dream and life, reality and delusion, transform into an affirmation of the manifold hallucinations, visions and machinations of the many ghosts that populate poetry. In Nerval's polyesthetic light-footedness and enchantment, affirmation and differentiating, condensing description do not arise in two separate states of dream and life, but in a multiplicity of shades that want to be written and read with the intensity and precision appropriate to them. "The dream killed life," wrote Nerval's friend Théophile Gautier in his obituary after Nerval's suicide in January 1855, but in Nerval's life, dreams were rather a vast land of material for his radical realism, leaning towards the lived experience. Gautier's interpretation is too much shaped by the end, by an end that had admittedly been plagued by fears, seizures, and breakdowns, by precarity and homelessness since the 1840s and increasingly so with the new decade of the 1850s. Gérard's legacy, however, is "The dream is a second life." This is how he begins his Aurelia, whose subtitle is not "The dream and the life for nothing." And it's not just dream in the narrower sense. What resounds through and illuminates this vast land of delirium is half-sleep, daydream, waking dream, imagination, illusions and visions, hallucinations and hallows, hearing voices and having second sights. The first drafts of Aurelia probably date back to Nerval's first breakdown and hospitalization in February 1841. This was preceded by real or imagined love dramas with the celebrated actress Jenny Colon in Paris and the star pianist Marie Pleyel in Vienna, which even overlapped in Brussels around the turn of the year 1840-41. In this respect, the figure of Aurelia is not to be understood as an identifiable female individual from Nerval's biography, but always as a constellation of a multiplicity of real and mystical female figures. In the first part of Aurelia, Nerval describes the first phase of what he calls his Vita Nuova, stumbling over the idea of calling it an illness, and I don't really know why I call it an illness, because I have never felt better for myself. End of quote. However, he elaborated only after a further stay in the clinic in 1853, along the last year of his life, as the conclusion of the second phase in which, from 1852 onwards, he wrote some new things, reassembled others, and published books that established his fame as the secret hero of the avant-garde of the early 20th century, and even the whole 20th century. This is also the period in which he realized that he could no longer fully control the influx of dreams into his life and increasingly violent experiences of crossing boundaries. After the first introductory pages of Aurelia, the first person narrator has just returned from the Aurelia Jenny Marie constellation in Brussels to Paris, planning to hurry back to my friends as soon as possible. One form of delirium follows another in quick succession. The second sight in the daydream is followed by a long nightmare, and the following evening by a series of delusional visions, including a seizure and a fall, which ends with a long stay in a clinic. Even if Nerval's confident descriptive and narrative style has changed with Aurelia into an often shaken and worry-driven vulnerability, his aim remains to be able to see dreams more clearly through radically realistic description. This clarification and elucidation of dreaming results in affirming and differentiating even the most drastic events and most delusional scenarios. Wearing glasses while sleeping in order to see dreams more clearly corresponds to the narrator's radical realistic spectacles in Naval's descriptions of experience in imagined landscapes, relationships, individual thing worlds. What was to transform into homelessness, extreme precarity, and disorientation in the last years of Naval's life was, in the early 1830s, the open testing of an experimental way of life. The aesthetics of existence of the Parisian Bohème Galant, as Nerval was to call it in the title of a volume of poetry 20 years later. An unruly artistic life in a dilated present that draws its models from the vagabond lifestyle of what Marx would denounce in the 18th Brumaire as Lumpenproletariat. As far as traveling and vagabonding are concerned, Nerval's Bohemian phase of the early 1830s is about the city and strolling, but later also about an escalating travel activity that is not only to be understood as a moment of unrest and deterritorialization, but also as the territory of a material that could be literarized in ever new layers, and this applies to the trips to the Orient as well as to the journeys to neighboring Germany or to those to the childhood landscape of Valois or to the surroundings of Paris. Throughout his life, Nerval has always experimented with the modes and genres of writing. Travelogues, dramas, short stories, translations, poems, prose poems, portraits, essays, literary criticism, journalistic articles, anthologies compiled or recompiled from existing texts, novels and novellas such as the works Sylvie, The Daughters of the Flame, The Illuminati, and the last novel Aurelia, which were often seen as models for, as I said, for the avant-garde of the 20th century. Nerval's practice of cutting up, fragmenting, tearing apart, of repackaging, recycling, reassembling, and reselling existing phases of delirium, he must produce according to the situation and quickly. But at the same time, though out of necessity, a style emerges and a literary technique of dissociation. Deleuze and Guattari write in Anti-Oedipus against Freudian practices of free association. It's the dissociation that comes in here. Of finely chiseled leaps and breaks that do not want to join despite or precisely because of their exact jointing as dissemblages and déconnages. The recomposition and refiguration of the texts is also about the intertextual process of playing with multiple and alienware temporalities. Flash forwards, flashbacks, combinations of times and confusion of tenses. His virtuosic and tumultuous handling of layers of time often leads to dizziness when reading, to the need to turn back pages and try to ascertain, Marcel Proust said that, how exactly one thing is interlaced with another. And even with all this turning back of pages and searching for balance, there is still a remnant of vertigo. An example of the unruly handling of time layers from the novella Pandora from 1854. Over New Year's Eve 1839-1840 in Vienna, Nerval stays for 3 months in a small room with laundresses in Leopoldstadt. Pandora appears to the first-person narrator here in the contemporary disguise of the pianist Marie Pleyel, who has invited him for New Year's Day. He drinks his way through the Sylvester evening alone and spurs on his nocturnal waking dreams with a red Tokai and a Bavarian beer and finally with a mug of Heurig mixed with a mug of old wine. Marie Pandora then transforms into Empress Catherine of Russia and things accelerate into a game with eternity which threatens to have an expiration date in the confusion of the course of times. As Pandora pollutes the air with her poisons, unblessed, I said to her, through your fault, we are lost, and the end of the world is at hand. But here, too, the end of the world appears rather as a possibility that threatens the individual. The first-person narrator fails to keep up with the goddess soaring up into the thousands or even millions of years foreseen for her, instead occupies himself with the devouring a few pomegranate seeds, jokes, threatens to suffocate, then his head is cut off, and I would have been dead in all seriousness if a parrot passing by quickly had not packed up some of the seeds I had spat out. A slightly different case of metempsychosis, and the parrot takes the seeds mixed with the first person narrator's blood to the Vatican, and so on. Naval's delirium is not delirium of domination, but bastardly delirium, délire bâtard, as Deleuze calls it in Critique and Clinic. And I would add disorderly queer delirium in the sense of the Latin delirare, to get out of the furrow, to deviate from the straight line. Furrowing normalization is the problem. Delirium, insofar, means queering, deviation, escaping from the normal, a minor life out of joint as deviance and delirium of dissemblages. And I come to my third and last part, Tosquelles as queer individual. In April, I drive to Saint-Alban, and the young woman who manages the tourist office in the old buildings of the asylum, whom I asked about archives on Tosquelles, refers me to the departmental archives in Mende. I am again delighted by the butchy coarseness of the women in the tobacco shop in Saint-Alban, which is also a souvenir store and a bookshop, and as I shuffle through the short aisles, I am visibly eyed as a potential thief and buy the same Tosquelles book as last time. Then I drive to Mende and first come across locked doors, not because I'm ignoring the opening hours, but if I understand correctly, because of the terror alert 3 months before the Olympic Games. With a little patience, however, the doors open and I can make myself understood with all kinds of broken languages. With the help of the Cerberus secretary, the friendly librarian, and a reserved yet courteous archivist, I managed to get hold of several finely knotted packages of documents, and I failed to return them just as finely knotted. They are a contradictory series of documents from the period in which Tosquelles is writing and defending his dissertation on the lived experience of the end of the world and on Nerval's Aurelia. And I might imagine that some of you know these documents. The handwritten note by a policeman with an illegible signature dated April 29, 1942, contains the statement that Dr. Tosquelles had an extremely negative influence on the entire staff of the hospital, clearly revolutionary and anti-national tendencies, end of quote. About 1 year later, the report on the political situation in the municipality of Saint-Alban to the prefect of Lozère is dated April 8, 1943. In it, Police Commissioner Rispoli from Mende reports about the suspicion that, quote, a dull anti-national agitation was manifesting itself in the psychiatric hospital and about a number of people whose loyalty to the government and the regime is highly questionable, who do not hide their sympathy for the Anglo-Saxon forces and who impatiently await the return of the Republic and a popular front government, end of quote. The longest part of the report is devoted to Tosquelles Laurado Francisco, born in Reus, Spain, married to Alvarez Fernandez Elaine, has 2 children, aged 7 and 1, who all live with him. A doctor of psychiatry in Spain, he was mobilized into the Spanish Republican Army during the Civil War as a lieutenant doctor and later captain doctor. In September 1939, he fled to France and he was interned in the Sept-Fonds camp. On January the 22nd, 1940, Tosquelles was assigned to the psychiatric hospital of Saint-Alban as a nurse at the request of the head physician of the institution, which was short of doctors due to the war. From a professional point of view, he's very satisfactory. Cultured and fluent in our language, Tosquelles rarely leaves the municipality or even the hospital. However, it should not be forgotten that Tosquelles was only assigned to Saint-Alban's hospital to compensate for the lack of management staff at this institution when many French doctors were mobilized. If the relevant circles decide that this situation has not changed since 1940, and the number of doctors is still too low, I think Tosquelles can stay in office. Otherwise, there is no reason to keep a Spaniard who is not tied to our regime and to whom common law should then be applied. End of quote. Tosquelles had to remain in this dangerous position for more than a year after the police investigation until the liberation, always under threat of being exposed as a member of the resistance or simply no longer defined as indispensable for the clinic. Shortly after the end of the war, in 1946, he began the lengthy process of naturalization for which, as Uri points out in his preface, his French dissertation would also become relevant. The same police department that had proposed his deportation less than 4 years earlier now attributed to him as a concrete reason for naturalization, aside of emphasizing his excellence as a physician and the possibility of making him head of a clinic, aside his assimilation to French customs and institutions above all, quote, during the occupation, he was very attached to the resistance and is said to have cared for many young people from the Maquis, especially the wounded of Montmouchy. End of quote. In 1948, the year in which the entire Toscaes family successfully obtained French citizenship, also Toscaes submitted his dissertation. The study is fed by multiple observation and records from clinical practice, which Toscaes analyzes together with his colleague and boss Bonafé, and enriches with insights from the growing field of psychiatric reflection. On the other hand, it also builds on a specifically artistic presence in and around Saint-Albans, and at the same time, the practice in Saint-Albans is, of course, also characterized by everyday artistic activities which emerged and persisted before, and that's important for me, before their identification and marketing as art brut, before the extraction of artistic practice from the social machine, and before the unambiguous branding as art of the mat or outsider art in the art field and among collectors. In this constellation of experiences of anti-fascist resistance, vagabonding psychiatry, and artistic experiments in Saint-Albans, an embodied knowledge emerges around the fact that artistic and poetic forms of expression cannot simply be read according to their content, interpreted only psychologically. While Carl Gustav Jung still interpreted Aurelia in his 1945 talk in Zurich in a completely prosaic, non-literary way as an autonosological exercise that Naval was told to do by his psychiatrist Emile Blanche and completely dutifully, Toscaes' reading can be understood as a complementary, subsistential reading that implicitly affirms the poetic aspects of the text. As a dissertation, it naturally had to satisfy the criteria of medical science, but it did not do so in opposition to Nerval's attitude critical of the clinic and affirmative of delirium, or in opposition to his refined literary composition. Toscaes writes, Aurelia is not only a literary work, but an experienced document of madness. We do no harm to the spirit of the work if we refrain from all aesthetic considerations in order to examine Aurelia as a clinical document. But this is not a question of stigmatizing it with a nosological label. End of quote. In a sense, this is not the opposite, but the flip side of what Ankerian quotes from Funcio Poetica y Psicoterapia, namely that we can consider mad people to be poets who have not been able to make the indispensable poem out of their lives. As Anne says, this is not about the irrevocable separation of mad and not mad, but at the same time, as this affirmation of fluid transitions, there is always a need to differentiate the subject positions, the social fields, and even more, the usages and modes of subjectivation and relation that are actualized here. This can also be subsumed under the concept of aesthetic existence. Aesthetics as the invention of new modes of subjectivation, as well as new forms of living together. Toscaes writes a whole chapter before turning to Nerval's text on the sphere of aesthetic existence according to Kierkegaard and the form of life of certain mentally ill people. Toscaes refers to Kierkegaard's concept of the spheres of existence and then specifically that of aesthetic existence. Quote, in aesthetic existence, one lives in an affective confusion of ego and world. If one enjoys all possibilities by actualizing them, one lacks all power over oneself. One recognizes oneself only darkly. The aesthete cannot achieve self-affirmation or self-acceptance. The self seems unreal to a certain extent. One lives in innumerable moments and plots. One feels liberated from all continuity of life, but the self that experiences and sees itself in this way is an enigmatic, depersonalized self. End of quote. One can place this theory of depersonalization in aesthetic existence, like Toscaes, in the clinical context of schizoid seizures and schizophrenia. But I would pose the question more generally as a search for experimental, unruly forms of life, as Pancho and Isabel were saying, of indiscipline, be they bohemian or neo-Dadaist or malat, in search of subsistential territories for the transversal machines between these territories and for the molecular individual revolution. Which brings us back to the vagabondage and Gérard Deneval as Fritz, who is supposed to bring his wigwam with him. Tosquelles reports on the examination of Dr. Barbier, who published the first clinical monograph on Aurelia in 1907, in which Naval is described as an alienated criminal, quote, because suicide can be described as the result of the criminal instinct, end of quote. Quite apart from the scandal of this judgment, Tosquelles and we are rather interested in Barbier's diagnosis of manie itinérante, which spread further and further and finally led to Naval becoming a real vagabond, end of quote. This is where we most clearly encounter the normalizing ideology of sedentariness, which identifies its outsiders as alienated criminals and vagabonds, be they traveling people, homeless city dwellers, or bohemian artists. In contrast, Théophile Gautier writes in his obituary of Gérard Deneval, although his appearance was often ragged, he was not in real misery. His friends' houses and their empty or full purses were also open to him when he was unable to work. How many of us prepared a room 10 times in the hope that he would spend a few days there? No one could be prepared for longer because his restless heart needed freedom. Like a swallow, when you leave a window open, he entered, walked around 2-3 times, found everything beautiful and charming, and flew away to dream again on his path. It was not indifference and coldness, but like the swift, the footless one, whose life is an eternal flight. He could never stop. End of quote. At a central point in Le Vécu, Tosquelles explains his view of Aurelia in terms of genre. In reality, Aurelia is a work that can be categorized neither as a novel, nor as a memoir, nor as a philosophical essay. Aurelia is poetry, experienced poetry. And this poetry, as Béguin says, decides the fate of its author. End of quote. Aurelia is poetry that actualizes the lived experience of delirium as a chain of events between dream and daydream, memory and hallucination. In the poetic recomposition, in the composition of the fragments, in stumbling over the breaks, the unspeakable is giving its place. The craft of condensation, the rhythm of writing, and the conscious technique of recomposing fragments of memory as a literary stylistic device create a individual machinic relationship in which the author and the swarm surrounding him wear many pairs of glasses. 4D glasses, hallucinatory glasses, psychedelic glasses. May they see dreams more queerly, and may queer here not be a subject, not a noun, but also not an adjective, but a stubborn adverb. As great as the image of the queer individual Tosquelles, as well as Stenschel or Nerval, with the messy hair, the often deviant language, and the seemingly ingeniously created concepts is, this individual perspective is not relevant to understand the queer quality of the Tosquelles machine. The queer is individual insofar as it is not a queer identity. It is anti-identitarian and becoming similar. It is not substance, always subsistential, always in something, under it and around it. In this respect, messy hair can be queer antennae, open arms, feelers that are attracted and touched by other hair and arms and feelers. Trans-Transcribe.